Well, I would really like to introduce you to Manjithra, because I've known Manjithra for 14 years. Because of where I was living, I didn't know that many people in the Western Buddhist Order, as it was then, Sri Ratna Buddhist Order now. And so it was really important to me to have, to meet people from the order, to sort of get a sense of that. And so occasionally sometimes you'd come and stay with us, and we'd meet you at different places. And one of the things that I've really, Manjithra is incredibly generous and incredibly creative, and he writes this really beautiful poetry, which I've often received in little presents, which is little booklets, which he's put his poems into. And he's the only person that does this that I know, that if there's my partner, who of whom Manjithra is a great friend, if he has a birthday or has some reason to have a present, Manjithra will give him a present, and he'll give me a present as well. And that was just, I don't know anybody else in the whole world that does that. And it was just, I was just so touched and delighted by that. He's also got a real sense of integrity and honesty, especially, well, I think that's when it's most noticeable, is when being honest and having that integrity is not easy, and means that you need to say things that other people may not be that willing to listen to. And he has a real passion for, naming the truth, even when that's maybe not comfortable. And that's a very impressive quality as well. He leads Wolf at the Door workshops and is widely known through the Tru Ratna Buddhist community as a fantastic workshop leader and a very creative inspiration. So I'll hand you over to Manjithra.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you very much. Okay. I'm hard of hearing. I have to wear hearing aids. So I sound like I'm in the Albert Hall. I don't think I am in the Albert Hall. Am I? Can you hear me? Because it's a strange thing about hearing aids, that in order to hear other people, I have to have them quite loud, but that makes my own voice sort of booming. I feel like Moses or something. If it's too loud, just go like that. And if it's not loud enough at any time, I won't be offended. Go like that. Okay. So, there was a great Russian poet called Joseph Brodsky. He died 15-20 years ago. He won the Nobel Prize, and he was a dissident poet in Russia. He was put into the camps. And he eventually got out, came to the West, ended up living in America. This isn't in my talk, but I've already gone. That's what I do. I spent hours writing a talk, and I've probably not kept to it now. But it is relevant, because Brodsky, he said two beautiful things that I've heard him say. One was, he was living in California, where I was living back in the 80s. And he said the difference between America and Russia, at that time, obviously Soviet Russia, was that in Russia, people took ideas seriously. And the way that was demonstrated was that if someone had, say, a book of poems, they would read it, learn it by heart often, and then pass it on to a friend so that they could do the same thing. Because these books, with their clandestine, maybe, illegal, illicit. And so they took poetry particularly so seriously that that's what they did. They risked their lives to read it. And he'd come to America where books were two a penny, and he was quite shocked at how frivolous, in a sense, people could be with ideas and learning. The other thing he said, which was what originally came to my mind, was that he said in an essay that if you're ever giving a talk, this is good advice, by the way, if you're ever giving a talk, or writing a book or an essay or something, always cut the first paragraph because it's there for you, not for your audience. It's to warm you up. So I'm being very clever because I'm using that teaching of Joseph Brodsky to warm me up. It's a sort of addition, but anyway, it's not a bad teaching, it seems to me. So I'm warming myself up. I have to say, I'm slightly nervous about what I'm going to do. Not badly. So I quite enjoy giving talks. I'm used to public speaking. But this one proved to be quite difficult, and it's partly because of the context. I'm not used to talking at Dharmapala. I did actually give a talk here last year about Karanal fundraising, but I'm not supposed to mention that. They're coming next. But very few people came, and most of the people came I knew, so it was more like a sort of party chat rather than a talk. So this is a new context for me. And also, this talk is essentially an overview of a book that I have just finished. It's called The Poet's Way, and it's about to be published. I've just done some proofreading. I think it goes to press in the next few weeks, and we're hoping it'll be out in August by Windows Publications. And it's a companion volume to a book called Writing Your Way, which some of you may know, which came out in 2005, and that's proved to be very successful for Windows, and so they were keen for me to do another book, which I'd always had in my mind, specifically about poetry. So this one's called The Poet's Way. And I think one of the reasons I found this hard to do was that I've literally just spent 8-9 months writing this book, and then I had to step back and think about giving a talk, and I really didn't want to do it because I really regretted offering it. Not now, but at the time, because it just felt like I've been thinking about this stuff for so long, I just want to stop. So I don't know if this is a good or bad piece, but it's what it is. The other reason I'm nervous, in comments, about this is that usually when I write talks, I write an essay, because I like to double up. So if you write an essay, you can get that published on that. And then you turn it in talk, so you get two things out of one bit of work. But I haven't had time to turn this from a paper into a talk. So we'll see what happens. Okay. So it's slightly... When you write for the eye, you can go into more detail than when you speak. I actually touch on this, certainly in my book. So there is a slight difference of nuance, so just bear with me. Something that I'm going to do is I'm going to read poems in between some of the talk, right? And if they're not, the first one I will say the poem and then the poet. If I just give you the title, it's by me. I suddenly thought it would be very weird to say, I can't remember what one's on me, A Guide to the Path by Manjushra. It's like, that is very strange, you know. He's sitting here talking. So I've decided not to do that. So if they haven't got a poet attached to them, they're by me. So just so you know. This is being recorded, so perhaps for posterity. So the good poems are probably attached somewhere else. Anyway, here we go. It's called The Poet's Way, which is the title of the book, How Words Used with Care Illuminate the Spiritual Life. Okay. It's a bit of a mouthful, but I was asked to give a brief explanation. Okay. Note by William Stafford. Straw, feathers, dust. Little things. But if they all go one way, that's the way the wind goes. Some things are too big to see. A few years ago, I was walking in London towards the post office tower, when suddenly it disappeared, obscured by the surrounding buildings. So if you remember, the post office is very tall. It used to be the tallest building in London. And suddenly it disappeared. It was only when I began to walk away that it reappeared. So it's quite a significant observation, walking, suddenly this huge building disappeared. I realized sometimes you're too close to things to see them. The same is true with us. We know we find some people irritating, some places beautiful, but do we really know why? It's very hard to see our tendencies since we're too close and too caught up with things. Like trying to take in the post office tower, we have to step back. A good way to do this is through writing, which not only takes us deeper into our experience, but leaves a trail, the words on the page, which we can return to for further analysis. Of course, this is true for all of the arts. They all leave a record of the search. But where's painting and music a more specialist medium? We all have access to language. The words I am using to give you this talk, the words you use to make a shopping list, write an email, they're all the same. The same words we would use in a story, a play, or a poem. The difference is only one of degree. Having spent the past 15 years teaching Wolf at the Door writing workshops around the world, I'm more and more convinced that there is not anyone who does not have things to say. Everyone's life is worth reporting. But the first and biggest step is to trust that this is so. So trust that we all have things to say, if we give ourselves a chance. To trust that through consistent effort we can become free from the limiting habits and views that undermine and undervalue so much of what we do. And undoubtedly the biggest and most pernicious of these ideas is the thought that we're not good enough. Okay. So I'm suggesting that I think one of the big hindrances to creativity is this idea that we're not good enough. So let me read you a delightful story that a friend of mine in New Zealand sent to me by email just a couple of weeks ago. I don't know where the story comes from. He just sent it to me. So if one of you wrote it, thank you, apologies, but I don't know where it came from. An elderly Chinese woman had two large pots hung on each end of a pole, which she carried across her shoulders. One of the pots had a crack in it, while the other one was perfect and always delivered a full portion of water. At the end of the long walks from the stream to her house, the crackpot arrived only half full. For 2 years this went on daily, and the woman bringing home only 1.5 pots of water. Of course, the perfect pot was very proud of its accomplishment. But the poor cracked pot was ashamed of its own imperfection and miserable that it could only do half of what it had been made to do. After 2 years of what it perceived to be a total failure, he spoke to the woman one day by the stream. "I am ashamed of myself because this crack in my side causes water to leak all the way back to your house." The old woman smiled. "Did you notice that there are flowers on your side of the path, but not on the other pot's side?" "That's because I've known about your flaws on your, so I planted flowers on your side of the path, and you water them every day while we walk back. For 2 years I've been able to pick these beautiful flowers and decorate my table. without you being just the way you are, there would not be this beauty to grace my house. By the way, I'm regretting that I typed this out in 12-point because it's very dark in there, so if I stumble occasionally, that's why. So this, I thought it was a charming story. Maybe some of you have heard it before, but I loved this image of the two pots, one leaking, one perfect. But the leaked pot was still doing what it did. It was watering the plants that the old lady had planted. So it's a charming story. It's our cracks and flaws that make us interesting. Moreover, it's only from the truth of our experience that we can gradually create something new. So I think this is a really, what in Buddhism is called a michaditti, a wrong view. There's this idea that we have to be perfect, and if we're not, there's something wrong. But actually I think our imperfections are often what make us interesting, or at least in part. So there's a strong tendency to feel we should be perfect straight away, and never leak any water. So we banish the old self and try and become a perfect pot immediately. But as the American poet Wallace Stevens said, it's easier to rise above life than work your way through it. A guide to the path. Small girl skipping down the road, ahead of her mother, making a dance with just the right amount of perfection. At Wolf of the Door workshops, we explore writing both prose and poems. But the reason for concentrating on poetry in this talk and in my new book, The Poet's Way, is that poetry provides us with limitations, and this is in fact a great gift. Why is this important? Well, in my experience, what gives us most trouble when we begin writing is not that we do not have enough to say, but that we have too much. Just think about that. This is an idea that came to me actually working on this book. But I think one of the things that often inhibits us when we try and start to write is that actually we've got too much to say. What I'm saying is the poetry, because it's very contained, actually can help us. I'll explore that. It's been noted that we write letters about our days, novels about a war, and poems about the moon. In other words, the bigger the subject, the more compact the form. The poem I opened with, by William Stafford, is just 18 words long, and yet within these few words is framed the whole metaphysics. The weaving of the large with the particular, the inextricable connectedness of things. So that the wind becomes a metaphor for... Well, of course, like all good writers, Stafford doesn't tell us. He leaves it for us to decide. Of course, the poem is about noticing things being carried along in the wind, but maybe it's also about being bullied at school, or political tyranny, or even conditioned existence itself. Straw, feathers, dust, little things. But if they all go one way, that's the way the wind goes. Because poems are so contained, putting a frame around our experience, they give us a chance to aim for just the right amount of perfection, rather than the all-or-nothing approach, which sabotages so much of what we do. The way to achieve perfection is to start with small things, or what Stafford calls the little things, and then to gradually build upon them. Hence, in Buddhist ethics, we're not simply extolled to live a good life, but shown how to do this by concentrating on our actions, our speech, and our thoughts. Remember, the Buddha didn't so much find an answer as a path, which we can follow. And paths are much more useful than answers. This is why the great 11th century Tibetan yogi, Milarepa, who was also a poet, said the most profound teaching in Buddhism is to practice. That's my favorite Buddhist teaching. The most profound teaching in Buddhism is to practice. This reminded me, originally I was a musician, I was a composer, and I was lucky enough to study at the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester. And in one of the years I was there, I was part of a thing called New Music Forum. We were putting on concerts of contemporary music. And we decided to put on a special program for a composer called Elizabeth Lutyens. I suspect most people wouldn't know who she was. She was the daughter of Edward Lutyens, the great architect who designed much of Delhi in India. But she was one of the first women in this country to become a composer, a classical music composer, so quite an accomplishment. She was a very grand lady. So we put on this concert, and I was given the task of sort of chaperoning her for the afternoon, which was slightly scary actually, because she was a very grand dame by this time. But she was a lovely, very charming, warm person. Anyway, I was sitting with Elizabeth Lutyens in the canteen in the music school, and this young woman approached very tentatively, so I could see she was nervous. And she came up to Elizabeth Lutyens and she said, "Please, Miss Lutyens, how do you become a composer?" And I always remember, so Elizabeth Lutyens gave a wry smile, and then she said, "It's very simple, my dear. You just sit down and write music." Which was a fantastic answer. And actually, I think it's very similar to Milarepa's "The Greatest Teaching in Buddhism is to Practice." If you want to be a composer, you have to write music. You're not going to be... There's no mute Milton, I think that's an old saying. You know, if Beethoven, Mozart, Stravinsky, Frank Zappa, all sorts of people, Miles Davis, if these people didn't sit down and work at their craft, then we wouldn't know them. So work is quite an important ingredient. Maybe you think this makes it sound too easy. This is a classic thing that comes up in workshop. What happens if you get stuck, if you've got writer's block? Well, the best teaching I know for this, and any of you who've worked with me will know this one, is something that William Stafford, the American poet, said, which is, if you can't write, lower your standards. Okay? I'll repeat that to the microphone. If you can't write, lower your standards. This is a fantastic teaching. I actually applied it last week because I ran out of time working on this talk, and I just, if you can't give a talk, mind you, so lower your standards. So, it's a beautiful, beautiful teaching. I've thought about this a lot over the last 10 or so years. I've sort of wondered, there must be times when that's not a good teaching. If you were a brain surgeon, probably not. But actually thinking about it, you've got to learn somewhere. You know, you can't just become a perfect neurosurgeon. Or pilot would be another one, wouldn't it? You'd be a bit nervous. So, "Hi, this is your pilot speaking. I've just decided to lower, not the wheels, but my standard." But actually, everything begins somewhere and you have to build on that. Right. And I think this is true in meditation as well. I make this point in my first book, Writing Your Way, that I think when we learn to meditate, and some of us, I'm sure, do meditate, we have perhaps this idea that we have to be the perfect meditator. So we're doing the metta bhavana, development of loving kindness, and we should suddenly be able to feel loving kindness, not just for ourselves, but for our friends, strangers, the whole world. Actually, I think it's easier to feel love for other people than yourself often. Or we do the mindfulness of breathing, and you're supposed to go count a breath, get to 10. You know, I've been doing this for 29 years, and I don't think I've ever got to 10 in all that time. So you can see why I learned to lower my standards, because I didn't have a lot to go on. But anyway, I think meditation is a really good place to practice lowering your standards. Just drop the idea that we should be doing this, we shouldn't be doing that. Just do what does. Every meditation is different. And actually every meditation is a victory, because it's another step in the right direction. Beautiful timing, that, don't I? Writing is not life itself, okay? It's a rehearsal for life. And I suggest that meditation should be a rehearsal for life too. It's a place to try things out. As Ananda, who's the co-founder of Wolf at the Door, who I work with, put it, the path, our mistakes are the path. Our mistakes are the path. I think that's very wise. You can see how that connects with the story of the pots. The Trees by Philip Larkin. The trees are coming into leaf, like something almost being said. The recent buds relax and spread. Their greenness is a kind of grief. Is it that they are born again and we grow old? No, they die too. Their yearly trick of looking new is written down in rings of grain. Yet still the unresting castles fresh, in full-grown thickness every May. Last year is dead, they seem to say. Begin afresh, afresh, afresh. When the English poet W. H. Auden was asked how he thought of his poems, he wittily replied, as oblongs and squares. Prose is articulated by sentences and paragraphs, but it's the white spaces around a poem, akin to the borders of a photograph, that tell us how a poem works, and that what is left out can be as important as what is put in. In the book, I go into some more detail. If you're not sure what a poem is, go into a bookshop. There are not many left on poetry, but those that still are out there. And just go to the shelves. And if you undo a book and it's got lots of words on lots of pages, it's not poetry. I can almost guarantee that. If you open a book and there's, perhaps you can see it, this is Larkin poem, and there's lots of white spaces around it, it's a poem. So if you do that, then you're well on the way. If it's got a lot of whiteness around the words, it's almost certainly going to be a poem. It's as simple as that, in a way. So each line is a step along a journey, because you've just got these little statements. Building on all that has gone before and influencing what will come next. Okay, to show what I mean, here's an example that was written for me by my friend Frau Witonska. I don't think she's here. She's not here. I saw her here last year. But anyway, I asked Frau, who's a very good writer, if she could come up with something to demonstrate this idea that poems work by lines. Okay, so this is what she did. And you're going to participate in this. So line one is, Mary raced down the road. Mary raced down the road. So what's going on there? Anyone? Someone who can shout, just tell me what you think that means, because I won't hear it. Anyone? Mary raced down the road. Someone said? Someone said, trying to catch a bus. Yeah, okay. Let's see. So this is the second line as well. Mary raced down the road. She was trying to catch up with them. That doesn't quite work now, does it? So what else could it be? Speak? Bicycle. Yeah, okay. Third line. Mary raced down the road. She was trying to catch up with them. She could already feel the loss.
Chasing after her friends,
yes. Okay. Mary raced down the road. She was trying to catch up with them. She could already feel the loss. The girl had broken her washing line. Okay. So we're all wrong so far. I'll give you the punchline. Mary raced down the road. She was trying to catch up with them. She could already feel the loss. The girl had broken her washing line. and blown her only knickers far away. So there's a lot of teaching in that, actually. We think we know what's going on, but we don't, actually. We hear snippets, and we build stories. This is a sort of aside. And it's worth reflecting on how much we do that and how wrong we get it. I'm terrible for doing this. I get a little bit of information, I create a whole thing around it, say about a person and why they do what they do and what they do, and it's terrible. And then, if you're lucky, you're contradicted and you realize that most of this was pure fiction on your part. And I'm suggesting one of the values of poetry is that it does work incrementally like this. So that it gives us a reminder that one thing leads to another, which is a very basic Buddhist idea, actually. You could say the whole idea of conditioned co-production, that things arise because of conditions, is embodied in poetry. A little poem like this. Each time you get a new line, a new idea, you have to slyly change what you thought was going on. And paradoxically, a poem's formal limitations, for example, that a sonnet has 14 lines or a haiku has 17 syllables, often means our mind becomes freer, because the imagination and unconscious are better left to their own devices when the conscious mind is preoccupied with technical questions. Okay? And I discovered a very striking example of this. Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, when he was composing, his wife would read the newspaper to him. So she'd be sitting there in the chair and she'd say, "Wolfgang, in Vienna today," and he'd be sitting there writing his 28th symphony or whatever, or maybe later on, which is quite a thing, isn't it? I mean, he also reputedly used to play billiards and compose in his head, and then he'd go home and write it all out. He said the art of composition was a good memory. But I think what's going on here with the newspaper and the composer is that his conscious mind, his rational mind, was being engaged with the daily news or whatever enough so that the unconscious, the less rational, the more imaginative, if you like, magical mind, was left to its own devices. And I think this is something that poetry gives us. If you've never tried writing poetry, you could try this and buy the book when it comes out, because what I do in the book is I take you step by step through writing a poem. And I think you'll find, I hope you would find, I think many of us do, that this formal question that poem posits actually frees up the imagination. I think many people would have guessed that trying to write a haiku which is only 17 syllables must be very, very limiting. Well, it is at one level, but at another level, a deeper level, it's actually very liberating. And that goes to the heart of my talk and the book, really, that it's this formal restraint that allows us to free up. And also, I think sometimes it allows us to write, poetry, in my experience, allows us to write about difficult subjects. And I remembered when I was writing this, I was teaching in Australia some years ago, and someone wanted to, on a workshop retreat, and someone wanted to try and start writing about the experience of growing up with a drunk father, which was obviously a very painful, difficult situation. And they'd been trying for a long time to write journal or memoir, and they just couldn't do it. And I said to them, "Why don't you try writing some poems about it?" And suddenly it became much easier for them. And I think the reason for this is that the shape of the poem gave them an element of objectivity, just allowed them to step back enough, you know, try and write a sonnet about this or whatever. It allowed for what Ananda calls this borrowed inch of choice. There's a degree of objectivity steps in. And I think particularly with difficult, painful, deep feelings, experiences, poetry actually allows us to get closer to them sometimes. This is a very common experience, I think. I think this is why we turn naturally, even instinctively, to poetry at times of high emotion. For example, when we fall in love, or when we fall out of love, when someone dies, when someone is born, I suspect most people, I bet most people have written a poem when they've fallen in love. Hands up who's written a poem when they've fallen in love. Hey, look at that. Good. Hands up those who wish they had written a poem when they've fallen in love. That's a good couple. Yeah, well, you can always, you know, you can always send someone a bit. W.B. Yeats, Robert Bly, who I worked with many years ago, he said to me that, he said, if you can't find a good love poem, send them Yeats, because he's probably better anyway. But anyway, poems sort of appear at these times in their life. And in the book, I used the example, which I know some people scorn this, scoff at it, but I remembered when Princess Diana, Lady Diana, died. You may remember. And suddenly, all around her house in Kensington, in London, the streets were adorned with flowers, but they were also, people were putting up poems on the lampposts, on the railings. And I found that really very moving, actually. I thought something important is happening here. When people feel that need to start addressing this figure, this goddess, in a sense, wasn't she? Through poetry, we know we've entered into magical space. And let's celebrate that. It's not corny. It's great. Okay, this is a poem called The Fountain by Denise Levertov. Don't say, there is no water to solace the dryness at her heart. I have seen the fountain springing out of the rock wall, and you drinking there. And I too, before your eyes, found footholds and climbed to drink the cool water. The woman of that place, shading her eyes, frowned as she watched, but not because she grudged the water, only because she was waiting to see we drink our fill and were refreshed. Don't say there is no water. That fountain is there, among its scalloped green and grey stones. It is still there and always there, with its quiet song and strange power, to springing us, up and out through the rock. Okay, so a wise friend once said to me, it's very hard to do nothing, okay? But actually they said something better than that. They said it's very hard to do nothing, pause, and still feel good about yourself. Now that's the real wisdom, it seems to me. This seems increasingly true as well in our culture, which is very kind of fast, sippy, you know, emails, texts, instant communication, all these things. They're all going on at the speed of light, essentially speed of electrons. And I think that they set a very high standard for us, so we feel we should be as productive as our computer, our mobile phones, all these things. And the truth is we're not, and why should we want to be? So I think it's very hard to do nothing and still feel good about yourself. And I count myself lucky that for the last 25 years I've been working for something called the Karanar Trust, and actually they're giving a presentation after me, so I'll just give a little bit of push for that. Karanar is a Buddhist charity that works in India with the new Buddhists, the ex-untouchables, people that call themselves Dalits, and I've been fundraising for Karanar, training fundraising for 25 years, and because of this I've had the chance to go to India. And this reminded me of something I saw, right, in India. So I'm on my way, I'm walking to Bhaja Retreat Center, which some of us here have probably been to. It's between Pune and Bombay, Mumbai, up in the Ghats, the hills. And I was walking to this place one day, very hot. And there's a little village sort of on the way from the railway station to the retreat center. And as my friend and I walked past, there was this old lady sitting with a pyramid of carrots. It was about this tall. So it was a pyramid of carrots. And, you know, if she was called Damien Hirst, she could put it in the Tate Modern and probably sell it for millions of pounds. It was absolutely exquisite. I take it that it wasn't a work of art. It was her selling carrots. Right. So the next day, my friend and I came back to get the train, and she was sitting there with this pyramid of carrots. Now, I don't know whether it was a different set of carrots. I hope so, for her sake, because I'm sure this was her livelihood, to sell the carrots. And the thought that came to me, because she didn't seem any different, it looked like the same carrot, she was sitting in the same way, she sort of looked at us a little bit, was, doesn't she get bored sitting here? Because I imagine she must do this. Maybe she's still there. Well, it's a bit late now, and it would be 11 in the evening, but earlier today, maybe she was sitting there with on the ground with her pile of carrots. And I thought, doesn't she get bored? And then I thought, I think that's the wrong question. I think that's a Western sensibility of time and activity and stimulation, that possibly, and I can only speculate, that her sense of time was very different. Now, it can only be speculation. But if that was what you did all day, you made your pyramid of carrots and then you sat there and sold them, I think perhaps your sense of time and purpose and activity would be changed. And I'd like to suggest that writing poems is a bit like this pyramid of carrots, okay? It's a completely, in a way, it's a useless thing to do. I mean, if you want to send a poem to your lover, that's a pretty good thing to do. But in a sense, poems are useless, aren't they? W.H. Auden said, poetry makes nothing happen. Actually, I just realized that making nothing happen is a really profound thing to do, because in a world where too much is happening, maybe nothing happening is really very profound. So, good old Winston. Anyway, so my suggestion is that one of the values of writing poetry is that it just slows everything down. And this is a wonderful poem by the great Chilean poet called Pablo Neruda. This is a version by Alistair Reid. It's called Keeping Quiet. And now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It will be an exotic moment, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in the sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the men gathering salt would not look at their hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victory with no survivors, will put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. I want no truck with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt the sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12. And you keep quiet, and I will go. If I was clever, I'd end the talk there and I'd walk up and go, but I missed a trip. That's a wonderful poem, that. I must admit, I mean, Neruda died, does anyone know who went to Neruda? It was 70s, I think.
Quite close to the time of the
the Allende, well, in fact, he died on the same day that Allende was assassinated, I think. This is an aside, but it's worth getting onto the tape. I discovered a wonderful thing about Nerudo. I was living in New York many years ago, and I used to read the Village Voice magazine. And there was this beautiful story that what happened was Nerudo was revered by the people, this wonderful, soulful poet. And he was murdered. He died naturally the day that Allende, the democratically elite, progressive leader of Chile, was murdered. There was a coup and he was over. And what would happen is people, Neruda lived by the sea in his house, beautiful house on the ocean, and people would go there to the sea walls and they would write lines of his poetry in chalk so that every day the tide would come in and wash them clean. And what a fantastic, it brings tears to my eyes actually, just thinking about it. What a wonderful, a tribute to a great poet, but also the power of this enchanted magic language that refused to die despite all the terrible oppressions, disappearances, horrible things went on there. That Neruda's words stayed alive on the seawalls and it gave people hope. So again, although Alden, who said poetry makes nothing happen, he wrote that in 1939 in a tribute to W.B. Yeats, and of course the world was moving inexorably towards the Second World War. But actually poetry makes a hell of a lot happen, and you only have to see in the dictatorships, the totalitarian regimes, you know, they go for the poets, don't they? Because they keep soul alive, I think, the heart, the spirit. Anyway, a lovely man called Michael Longley is an Irish poet. He says that in order to write poetry you need not just space, but space around the space. And I think that's a really lovely, charming idea. But I think it's true. In my experience, one of the great gifts of writing poetry is that a lot of time you're just sitting around doing nothing. I reckon about a 12th, to use Neruda's number, of the time writing a poem is actually words on the page. The other 11 twelfths, you're just staring out the window, you're looking around, you're getting distracted, your wife's reading you the news, whatever. Because I think that's how poetry works. It works, it seeps through that image Denise Levertov used of the fountain of the well bringing up. I think that's how poetry works. I'm sort of running out of time, so I'm going to, you don't know this, but I'm going to cut a few things here. This can only be, this is quite impressionistic, and that's okay, because it's a talk about poetry. I'm just giving you little snapshots. That poetry is encapsulated, it's contained, and that's a great gift because it helps us to step back and yet step in. And that poetry makes nothing happen, so it creates space for us. These are two really beautiful gifts, I think, for poetry. There was a great Chinese poet called Li Po, Ming Dynasty. And his friend Tu Fu, I'm sure I get the pronunciations wrong, but Li Po had a friend called Tu Fu. And they used to send each other poems by letter. And Li Po wrote to Tu Fu after he'd sent him some poems and said, "Thank you for sharing your poems with me. It was like being alive twice," which is a fantastic image. "Thank you for sharing your poems. It's like being alive twice." And I think what I took from that is that when you read someone else's writing, and of course not just poetry, you enter into someone else's world, okay? But I think this is particularly true of poetry, which is such a personal, contained expression of one's being. That it's like the raw material, it's the pure, it's the depths, you know. It's the main line there. So when you get someone's poem, and I think that's why it's good to send people you've fallen in love with poems, because it's an expression of your being to them. So it's very precious. Anyway, it's like being alive twice. And this reminded me of something that Ian McEwan, the English novelist, said. I think he said quite a challenging thing, actually, but I think very wise. Soon after the attacks on the World Trade Center, September 11, 2001, McEwan wrote in the Guardian newspaper that the great crime that had been committed ultimately was to the imagination, which is quite provocative, because he said that if you really thought about what you were going to do, if you were sending planes into buildings like that, if you imagined for a moment the consequences of that, could you really do it? One would like to think not, huh? And then, but what that led me to think is that fanaticism, one of the problems with fanaticism is that it doesn't give space for that kind of reflection. It doesn't allow you to be alive twice. You're only alive once, and then you just go for it, and then you blow it all up. It's very nihilistic in that sense. So I love this idea of McEwen's. I think it's a brave thing to have said, that it's the failure of the imagination that causes these terrible atrocities. It stops us being alive twice. So I'm coming to an end, but I really wanted to read this poem. It's one of my favourite poems. It's from Birthday Letters by Ted Hughes, which you may remember came out just before he died. And it was a whole series of poems about his relationship with Sylvia Plath, his first wife. Of course, a very great poet who tragically committed suicide. And I love this poem. It's called Epiphany by Ted Hughes. It's quite long, so just sit back and enjoy. Okay. I think it has something important to say. London. The grimy lilac softness of an April evening. Me walking over Chalk Farm Bridge on my way to the tube station. A new father, slightly light-headed, with the lack of sleep and the novelty. Next, this young fellow coming towards me. I glance at him for the first time as I passed him, because I noticed, I couldn't believe it, what I'd been ignoring. Not the bulge of a small animal, buttoned into the top of his jacket, the way colliers used to wear their whippets, but its actual face, eyes reaching out, trying to catch my eyes, so familiar. The huge ears, the pinched urchin expression, the wild, confronting stare, pushed through fear, between the jacket lapels. It's a fox cub. I heard my own surprise as I stopped. He stopped. Where did you get it? What are you going to do with it? A fox cub on the hump of Chalk Farm Bridge. You can have him for a pound. But where did you find it? What will you do with it? Somebody will buy him. Cheap enough. At a pound. And a grin. What I was thinking was, what would you think? How would we fit it into our crate of space with the baby? What would you make of its old smell and its mannerless energy? And as it grew up and began to enjoy itself, what would we do with an unpredictable, powerful, bounding fox? The long-mouthed, flashing temperament, the necessary nightly 20 miles, and that vast hunger for everything beyond us. How would we cope with its cosmic derangements whenever we moved? The little fox peered at me. The little fox peered past me at other folk, at this one and at that one, and then at me. Good luck was all it needed, already past the kittenish, but the eyes still small, round, orphan looking, woebegone, as if with weeping. Bereft of the blue milk, the toys of feather and fur, the den, life's happy dark, and the huge whisper of the constellations, after which mother always returned. My thoughts felt like big ignorant hounds circling and sniffing around him. Then I walked on, as if out of my own life. I let that fox cub go. I tossed it back into the future of a fox cub in London. And I hurried straight on and dived, as if escaping, into the underground. If I paid that pound and turned back to you with that armful of fox, if I'd grasped whatever comes with a fox is what tests a marriage and proves it a marriage, I would not have failed the test. Would you have failed it? But I failed. Our marriage had failed. So now the reins. Actually, it's not inappropriate that we're in this tent, fortunately. Outside there is the rain. You can start making connections. This is a wonderful poem, I think. Do read it. It's in birthday lists. It's called Epiphany. And this strange encounter, Ted Hughes, he's just had his first daughter, Frida, who in fact is a poet herself. And he meets this little boy who's selling a fox cub for a pound in the middle of London. It's very sort of disturbing image, and yet fascinating. And so for me, it's the wildness coming in to the domestic, the wolf at the door of our workshop. So here we are in the comfort of the tent, but out there is the wind and the rain. You probably wouldn't mind if I carry on talking, actually, because we're going to get wet. But we've got a little time to take questions. Speak up. Okay. I will come to a close, but I just wanted to tell you the fox was a very important image for Ted Hughes. There's a wonderful story he told of, he was studying English at Cambridge University. And he was getting more and more frustrated, having to write essays about the great poets, the great novels. And he'd gone to study English because he knew he wanted to be a writer, he wanted to be a poet. And he thought studying English would help him, but he gradually, quickly realized that it was actually doing the opposite, it was killing something. And one night he'd been trying to write an essay all day, and he got completely stuck. So he went to bed, he went to sleep, and he had this dream. And in this dream, this half man, half fox appeared, came into his room. And this was quite a wretched image, because this fox looked like it had stepped out of a furnace. It was scorched, completely burnt. He called the essay he wrote about it, The Burnt Fox. So imagine this, if this dream, there's this scorched half man, half fox, comes into his room, walks up to his desk where his essay is sitting unfinished, and says, "Will you stop doing this? You are killing us. Will you stop doing this? You are killing us." And it laid its hand on the paper, on the essay. Okay? Hughes said that he woke up immediately, obviously a nightmarish. And if you read this essay, it's very matter of fact, but he says a really interesting thing, actually. He says, "So I got up and I walked over to the paper, knowing there would be this imprint in blood on the paper." It wasn't maybe there would be this imprint, knowing there would be this imprint of blood. And he ends the essay like this. So we don't actually know. Did he see that mark? Did he not? But I think, and I think he would have said, that's probably when he became a poet, and he became a great poet, clearly. Because he didn't question the power of that dream. He took it as reality. It was a deeper reality coming into his world, into his life, so much so that he knew he would see the print of the fox man on his page. And I think that that's one of the, that perhaps I would say is the great gift to poetry, that it helps us to trust the more mythical, more magical aspects of life. And I think these things do happen if we allow them. I think we spend a lot of energy keeping these mythical, magical images at arm's length because that feels safe. But when you let them in, things start to happen. William Stafford, to quote him again, finally, he said, always do your writing in the wilderness. Always do your writing in the wilderness. So I think poetry is one of those places where we can bring a bit of the wilderness into our lives and take risks and try things out and see what happens. Siddhartha. If you didn't know, Siddhartha was the name of the Buddha. That was his family name. Siddhartha. Something called to him, repeated over and over, and he noticed.